Counsel, the case, next case before us this morning is 20-3230, Williams v. Aeroflex, Wichita. Please, counsel for appellant, would you proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jennifer Hill. May it please the court. I'm here today representing Linda Williams on her hostile work environment discrimination and retaliation claim against Aeroflex, a manufacturing and servicing company. It was based out of Wichita, Kansas during the relevant time period. I would request 4 minutes of rebuttal time if that would be acceptable to the court. This morning, each of us got ready for work. We brushed our teeth. We wore clothes that we felt was appropriate for our roles in society and our roles in our work. Now, I'd like you to imagine that while you were getting ready, you knew that when you arrived at work, there was a distinct probability that you'd be humiliated, that you'd be degraded by your boss in front of your coworkers, that you'd be mocked openly for your intelligence, and that your mistakes in the workplace wouldn't just be pointed out, but they'd be discussed and made fodder for humiliating and embarrassing experiences. What would you do if you had your coworkers engaged in a spy game, emailing your boss mistakes that they found about your work? And imagine if the processes for your work changed and you were expected to know about those changes and you would get in trouble if you didn't, conform your conduct accordingly. And then imagine further that that happens every day for 16 years. For 16 years, you're humiliated, you're harassed, and you're subjected to workplace distress. Unlike the side effects that's mentioned in the district court memorandum and order, this results in anxiety and depression, hair loss, headaches, nausea, insomnia, and ultimately the only way you're able to get to work every day is if you go on medication and you have actual therapy appointments to help you work through this process. After 16 years, it would be enough. You would ask for help, you would ask for intervention. And imagine further then that you were the only worker in your office with your color of skin. While there wasn't direct commentary that your color of skin was the subject for this treatment, it became readily apparent that people who didn't have your color of skin were treated differently.
Let me stop you there, if I may. The Supreme Court talks about the notion that, and we've talked about this, in essence, that Title VII is not a civility code. And that that we're not here to police good behavior in the workplace per se. Why isn't it, help me to understand why this is not the classic example of Ms. Cromwell just being an equal opportunity SOB, I mean, to everyone. And why would that form the basis for a Title VII claim? I mean, accepting all the allegations that are put forward here, it appears that she treated everybody poorly.
I believe if you review, there's 4 depositions in the record before you and a body, many, many bodies of documents. 3 of the 4 depositions strongly stand for the proposition that Cromwell did not treat everyone harshly, that while she was a strict boss, her absolute resentment and disgust for Linda Williams was open, obvious, and remarkable to everyone who worked in that office. It is simply more than just she's a strict boss and everybody's under a tight, she's running a tight ship. That was Cromwell's own words. To the contrary, you have 2 outside witnesses who have no stake in this game. They are third party. They hadn't spoken to Linda Williams in years prior to their depositions. And if you review their deposition transcripts, they said that when Ms. Cromwell found a mistake in other workers' work product, she would carefully pull them aside, point out the mistake, and respectfully help them make the correction needed to be made. When Linda Williams made a mistake, the whole office knew about it. It was
What witnesses are you talking about?
I'm talking about Emily Craig. I'm sorry, Emily Trimpe and Aaron Craig.
Okay. Why, as it relates to, let's use the example of mistakes. why is Ms. Williams similarly situated to everyone else? I mean, she's been there longer than everybody else. Why can an employer legitimately hold her to a higher standard than everybody else? You've been here 16 years and you can't do the same thing, right, that we've talked about for 15 years? Why, as opposed to someone who's only been there 3 years? Isn't that a legitimate basis of distinction between Ms. Williams and the others?
It would be a legitimate basis if, in fact, I don't think there's anything that says if you've been here longer, I get to treat you worse. I don't think there's any kind of allowance for that under Title VII or anything else.
Well, the question at essence is always, was that different treatment based on her race? And that's the only thing that we're here to talk about. And correct. So if she had been there 16 years and somebody had been there 2 years and she decided and Ms. Cromwell decided, I'm going to treat you more harshly, Ms. Williams, because you should know better. Then the question still boils down to, did she do that because of race? And so that leads to my second question. Where in the record is there anything where Ms. Williams talks about race to anybody, where anybody else talks about race to anybody? I mean, Miss Williams doesn't mention race as a basis for, she equivocates about that, doesn't she?
She does. In fact, in 2003, the very first time she goes to Human Resources seeking help, her statement to Margie Hale, who is the Human Resource professional, is she's tired, she can't take it anymore, and she fears that Ms. Cromwell is racially prejudiced. That conversation happens on Thursday, January 30th, 2003. The very next day, you can question whether it's retaliation or not. We don't know what's going on inside Ms. Cromwell's head, but Ms. Cromwell writes up Ms. Williams for her attitude. Then 1 week later, after Ms. Williams is sick.
And was Ms. Cromwell aware, remind me, was Ms. Cromwell aware, does the record support that she was aware of the 2003 conversation?
We do not know. And Ms. Cromwell could not recall in her deposition if she was aware of the 2003 complaints. What we know is that Human Resources was aware and Ms. Cromwell's supervisor was aware of
the concerns. Well, you said whether it gives rise to inference of retaliation or not. Well, you haven't told me anything that would allow it to give rise.
We know that during that conversation with Ms. Hale, Ms. Williams expressed to Human Resources a very sincere concern that she was going to get in trouble for being away from her desk and in Human Resources. So if that is enough for Ms. Cromwell to be aware that Ms. Williams was in Human Resources possibly making a complaint, we can't know the answer to that question. But what we know is that one day after going to Human Resources, she gets a write-up. We also know that in 2011, Ms. Williams reports to another Human Resource professional that an unfair write-up is happening. And she says, I just want to be treated the same as everyone else. We know that 1 year later, in 2012, that same Human Resource professional, Ms. Tindall, takes an email and has a conversation with her, wherein Ms. Williams again says she believes it's possible that there's racial prejudice going on. Aeroflex has multiple occasions throughout the career, the 16 years, that Ms. Williams believes there is a potential for racial motivation. It's interesting to note that if you look at what Human Resources did in response, they went to Ms. Cromwell's supervisor. They didn't go to a single coworker and say, hey, real quick, do you think there's something racial going on here between Ms. Cromwell and Ms. Williams? That is never asked until 2016. And in 2016, a worker who was not in the room with Cromwell and Williams, the receptionist, said she believed it was possible that race was a factor. She didn't witness it, but she thought that it could be on the table. Ms. Tindall did nothing with that information. I'm sorry, Judge.
Oh. Well, I was just going to just add a little different approach to it. You've been answering about what the evidence showed about whether there was racial or not. But I'm concerned about even more than that, what the allegations were, regardless of the evidence. You look at her filings, and I didn't see that her filings raised, you know, her claim raised race. And so no matter what the evidence showed, if she didn't raise it in her EEOC filing, isn't that the end of the matter?
Her Her EEOC filing is specific and generic at the same time. Her EEOC, or her, is, I guess, a Kansas human rights complaint. And it states, and it states from August to October, her work was more closely scrutinized than other similarly situated employees. She was subjected to written and verbal harassment.
Right, but there's the word race is not there, but I'm looking not at her complaint. I was looking at her EEOC complaint, rather. There's just no reference there. As she says, I've had it with this woman. I can't take it anymore. But I do not see that she preserved in a claim the word race or the equivalent of race, no matter what the evidence shows. So I want you to address that for me.
Sure. Judge, I'm reviewing her administrative charge with the Kansas Human Rights Commission. And in that charge, she makes very clear statements that she's treated less favorably than similarly situated employees. Very clearly, she's talking about race.
Not very clearly at all. Unless there's another allegation that I'm the only Black and the others are white, there's just nothing like that in there.
The record in this case establishes that from very early on, Ms. Williams suspected that she was the subject of race discrimination. She did not have overt.
She said that, but not part of her claim. Not part of her EEOC claim that was a necessary preservation to present to us in the courts.
And Judge, I guess I'm not aware of what her EEOC claim is. I'm only familiar with her Kansas human rights charge, which was filed by Ms. Williams in October of 2016.
I really am referring to that as well.
Okay. Yeah. That's the document I'm aware of where she outlines her administrative claims. And she does not say specifically that she was criticized for being Black. This is a circumstantial evidence case, no question. There is not racial epithets. There are not statements like you're stupid because you're African-American. We admit that we don't have that in this case. But in this district or in this circuit, there are plenty of cases where a single person in a protected class is treated so distinctly differently from everyone else in the workplace that it raises an inference. And when the evidence is that there is third party witnesses who agree it's race related, and they can't say it's because Ms. Cromwell said the word Black, it's just a general observation that they have made during their work in this environment. They observe the day in, day out conduct of these parties for over a year each.
But if she
and
felt
they reached that,
that
conclusion.
If she felt that, didn't she have an obligation to say, and this, because I'm the only Black, and I'm not even sure that there's evidence in the record that she was the only Black, but let's assume that that's true. I guess I'd like your comments on that. But assuming that, you could treat a only Black person worse if that only Black person really was performing worse, couldn't you?
If there was actual evidence of problems with Ms. Williams' employment that the defendant created or produced in this case, that would be fine. What's interesting in this case is that everything that was subjectively entered into the documents in this case show that Ms. Williams did not have problems with her performance. Other coworkers who testified said that she was better than they were at the job, that there were no errors in her work. And
wasn't she on a performance improvement plan in which she, in fact, got better in terms of her error rate over time under that plan?
Correct. Miss 2 days after rejecting a write-up from Miss Cromwell, Miss Cromwell decided that she needed to analyze Ms. Williams' work more closely to see if there were errors. Ms. Cromwell specifically started finding errors in Ms. Williams' work in September of 2016. The error rate, which was subjectively identified by Ms. Cromwell, improved from 76% to 94%, according to Ms. Cromwell. And what's interesting is that even after reaching a 94% accuracy rate as measured by Ms. Cromwell, Ms. Cromwell continued to rate Ms. Williams lower than her coworkers and make statements to other people in the company that she just can't rely on her. She's got a 94% accuracy rate, which according to everyone in the company is as good as they hope for. They hope for 90 to 95% accuracy. She's reached it, and Ms. Cromwell continues to put into the evidence that she is downgrading Ms. Williams lower than her fellow employees who are white. And she's finding in this case that Ms. Williams just can't be relied upon. That situation continued for another year until the attorneys got involved and got Ms. Williams transferred, wherein, surprisingly enough, with a new supervisor, she had no complaints about her performance and no complaints about a hostile work environment. She continued to work at Aeroflex until they had a reduction in force during the pandemic.
Ms. write-ups. We may consider giving you a little bit of time, but you're out officially. So let's just stop there and hear from the other side.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Teresa Scholda, and I represent the appellees Aeroflex Wichita, Inc. and Lori Cromwell in this case.
Ms. Scholda, could I just start you with this? My understanding of the record, and Ms. Hill leads me to believe maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding of the record is that Ms. Cromwell was perceived uniformly as being a tough, harsh boss. Am I wrong on that? And if I'm not wrong, where could I find support in the record for that?
Your Honor, you are not wrong. The record does support that conclusion. The record is replete with evidence that other non-Black employees, as they exited, either voluntarily, that they filled out exit interviews that specifically pointed out that they bristled at Ms. Cromwell's micromanaging management style. One of the witnesses that Ms. Williams relies on, Ms. Craig. Ms. Craig, in her deposition testimony, specifically said that Ms. Cromwell created an environment for Ms. Craig that was awful, toxic, and unpleasant for Ms. Craig herself, who is not Black. Ms. Cromwell herself submitted evidence that she issued write-ups to many other employees, almost all of whom were non-Black, upwards of 30 disciplinary measures for 12 employees. She terminated, over the course of Ms. Williams' employment, she terminated 9 employees, all of whom are not Black. Ms. Cromwell also testified, and it is not disputed or rebutted in any way, that it was very common for her to give verbal reprimands and coachings. And she testified that she had probably given hundreds of verbal reprimands and coaching on work rules, work performance, attendance, issues over time. So you are correct, Your Honor, that the record is replete with evidence that
on the verbal reprimands and coaching, I think one point of grievance by Ms. Williams was that hers was in public. Is there evidence of her giving verbal reprimands and coaching to others in public?
Yes, actually, Ms. Williams herself testified that Ms. Cromwell would go to the desks of the employees she was coaching or reprimanding, and the employees around that employee's desk could hear what Ms. Cromwell was saying. So there is evidence, even in Ms. Williams' own testimony, that Ms. Cromwell would reprimand employees at their desk. It was an open environment. There were no cubicle walls or anything, and that she would reprimand other employees and that the employees around could hear.
Was there anybody who led Bennett Aeroflex anywhere near the period of time that Ms. Williams had been there?
No, Ms. Williams had been working under Ms. Cromwell's supervision for 17 years. The next closest, most senior employee was 9 years. The majority of the employees in this customer service department, their tenures were typically between 1 and 6 years. It's an entry-level position. There's high turnover. It's a customer service job. Employees would leave either because they didn't like Ms. Cromwell's management style or for other opportunities. So no, there were no other employees that were similarly situated in terms of tenure.
Counsel, could I just jump in at the pause? Could I get you to Well, tell me what you do with the statement of Emily Trimpe, who said, if everybody else in the office is one skin tone and nobody is treated in a harsh manner except the person that is not of that skin tone, it's hard not to at least come to a similar conclusion. What do you do with that statement?
The fact that for a period of time, Ms. Williams was the only Black employee in this work group is not dispositive. If that is the only connection to the race-based allegations in this case, this court has held over and over again that is not sufficient by itself to sustain either a race hostile work environment or a race disparate treatment claim. There must be some evidence of overt race-based conduct to sustain that beyond being the only employee of that protected category. And so Ms. Trimpe made the conclusion that because there was only one Black person during the short time period that she was there, she made the conclusion A plus B equals C. But this court has time and again rejected that proposition. And
this case, could you give us a couple of those cases, please?
Yes, I can. Palmer versus Kaiser Foundation. That was a race hostile work environment. All of the allegations were race neutral. They were accusations of bullying, intimidation,
I need you to give me the facts. I just want you to give me cases where we held that there has to be some evidence of racial animus in a situation where there is clearly animus against somebody, but that person is the only one in the office with that particular race.
Yes. So Palmer versus Kaiser Foundation is one example. I have a list of cases where the court has held and followed that while you can consider race neutral conduct and the totality of the circumstances, there has to be some overtly race-based conduct or sex-based in the case of sex discrimination. Those cases include Young versus City of Idabel, Bird versus West Valley City, and of course, O'Shea versus Yellow Tech Services, which is the case that many subsequent decisions have relied upon for that concept.
Going back to Ms. Trimpe's statement, the passage that Judge Ide read suggested that Ms. Trimpe's belief was that there was disparate treatment at play. In other words, that Ms. Williams was the only one being treated harshly. Was it probed in her deposition whether there was any basis for that belief in the disparate treatment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is one thing I do want to point out, because the district court, in a footnote of their decision, they specifically said, while we're going to take these allegations in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the record very thinly supports these allegations. And when these witnesses, including Ms. Williams, were pressed for details, examples, so one of the witnesses, either Craig or Trimpe, said, well, Ms. Cromwell was mean. When pressed for the details, what does that look like? Give me examples. They were really unable to articulate examples other than the ones we already know about, which are the Richard Simmons comment and the paper throwing incident. But beyond that, when pressed for details, both Ms. Craig and Ms. Trimpe said, I'm sorry, I can't give you specifics. I can't give you details. I wish I could, but I can't.
And let me play this out a little bit. Do you have a sense of what the authority is that addresses the proposition about belief? In other words, if you have somebody who, and I was listening carefully to Ms. Hill when she was recounting testimony, there was a lot of talk about belief. I believe that she may have been racist. I fear she may have been racist. If that ends up being all there is, belief, without examples or without being able to point to anything objective, is that enough?
No, Your Honor, it is not. And I would cite to Bird versus West Valley City, which is a case decided by this court in 2016. There was evidence in that case of other employees who said they perceived that their male supervisor was treating females different. And the court concluded that these vague and conclusory generalizations, rather than specific examples of gender-based conduct, was not enough, that those conclusions had to be supported by some level of specificity. I do want to address, if there are no more questions on the hostile work environment claim, I do want to address briefly the other claims that are at issue in this case. I do believe on the hostile work environment claim, I really do believe it comes down to the two prongs that Ms. Williams just can't establish. One, that the conduct was based on race. Admittedly, there is no overt, even one piece of overt race-based evidence that could tie all this race or neutral conduct together to make a hostile work environment claim. And the lack of severity or pervasiveness in the hostile work environment claim also fails. For much the same reason that the hostile work environment claim fails on the connection to race, the disparate treatment claim fails with regard to the connection to race. I do want to point out that the disparate treatment claim truly is different in terms of the scope of the conduct that can be considered. In the hostile work environment claim, of course, the court can and should and did in this case look back at the course of conduct over time to consider whether or not race played a factor. In the disparate treatment claim, while you can look back at that conduct to try to figure out if there was a race-based element, you do have to look at the time period that is outlined in the charge of discrimination to determine if there was disparate treatment and a subsequent adverse action from that disparate treatment. And in this case, again, even when Ms. Williams filed her complaint with the corporate office, she did not allege overtly or specifically that race was causing the treatment that she was receiving from Ms. Cromwell. And the allegations of what kind of treatment she suffered during this time period that she alleged in her charge are things like the September 20th disciplinary action related to abusive break time. That was ultimately withdrawn. The monitoring system where Ms. Cromwell monitored her accuracy rate. Not only was she not the only person who was subjected to that monitoring, two white employees were also subjected to the monitoring at the exact same time period. So not only was she not treated differently, but this court has ruled that monitoring by itself is not a disparate or is not an adverse action that can support a disparate treatment claim.
And when you said complaint to the corporate office, are you talking about her cry for help email or what are you talking about?
Yes, I am talking about her October 6th email to the corporate office in the UK that she titled My Cry for Help. She outlined, in her words, a bad work environment. I mean, no bones about it, but she did not allege that it was based on race. And she even pointed at other factors like the high turnover rate in the office. And how different points in the investigation, she explicitly said, you know, Ms. Cromwell treats the new people better than she treats the more senior people. And Ms. Cromwell testified herself, I have higher expectations for the more senior people than I do for the newer tenured people. So for purposes of the disparate treatment claim, it fails again on two prongs. One, again, there's no connection to race whatsoever in disparate treatment. There's plenty of testimony that others were monitored who were not Black. Others had been given discipline over time. And with regard to the dress code violations that were during this time, Ms. Cromwell testified she had reprimanded three other non-Black employees for dress code violations related to their shoes and the length of their skirt. None of these employees received formal discipline. They received only verbal reprimands, which is
you're not suggesting that any of this rises to the level of an adverse action. My understanding from your brief was you contest that point.
Just the opposite. That not only is it not race based, and she wasn't treated differently, but none of these things by themselves or collectively could rise to the level of an adverse action.
Can I ask quickly about the criticism of her hair?
Yes.
Could it have related to the style, the way she maintained her hair, or the racial characteristics of that hair, or was it strictly that I didn't like the smell of it? Was it anything broader than just smell?
So there were two allegations regarding Ms. Williams' hairstyles. One occurred in 2013, and the allegation is that Ms. Cromwell asked her in front of others, how many times are you going to change your wig? That's the long and short of the allegation. The allegation regarding the smell of her hair occurred in December of 2016, and the allegation is that Ms. Cromwell, who Ms. Williams admits has a sensitive smell, that she's sensitive to odors. Ms. Williams admits that in her deposition, that Ms. Cromwell walked into the office and said, what is that smell? Ms. Williams said, I think it's my hair oil. And the allegation is that Ms. Cromwell responded, oh, that makes me feel like spewing. That again, that's the long and short of it. No allegations that it was based on any type of race-based hairstyle, just what's that smell? Not even directing it towards Linda Williams, just directing it to the room. What's that smell? And Linda volunteered, Ms. Williams volunteered that it was the smell of her hair oil.
Thank you. Thank you.
It looks like I'm out of time. I thank you, Your Honors, for listening to our arguments today.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hill, 1 minute, use it wisely.
Thank you, Judge. Real quickly, I think it's important that we look at the totality of the testimony from Craig and Trimpe. We know that Craig and Trimpe stated that she mocked her clothes up to what she was wearing up to three times a day. That's far more than just an occasional statement of correcting an error. We know that we mocked that, according to those witnesses, she mocked her mistakes openly in front of coworkers and treated Linda Williams worse than she would treat a dog. There were very specific instances of conduct far beyond what was outlined by counsel. I would encourage the court to very closely review the Palmer decision cited by counsel. That's a pro se plaintiff that provides no legal analysis in its case on this issue of being the only person in the protected class. I also think that it's important to go back to the Strickland case that we rely heavily on pages 43 through 47 in our brief. In the Strickland case, there's very clear statements that this circuit says discriminatory animus can be proved by showing that the harasser treats members of a protected class differently than others. It does not have to be specific to that protected class. A supervisor speaking more harshly and condescendingly, enforcing policies strictly and inconsistently, and hounding a worker in a protected class in a way that they don't the other coworkers can create a question of fact. That doesn't mean 100% Linda Williams wins her case. It means that she has created a question of fact.
There okay, is- I don't want to cut you off, but that I need to cut you off.
Okay. Thank you,
counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted.
Thank you.